She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Our show today is made possible through the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group. As always, we thank them for their support and for definitely doing their share and showing they care. Hats off to the Community Green team at Chapman for all their hard work throughout the year. The name of our show today is actually the name of the book we will be discussing, Project Animal Farm, An Accidental Journey into the Secret World of Farming and the Truth About Our Food. Our guest is the author of that book. Her name is Sonia Faruqi. She is a graduate from Dartmouth College. She worked on Wall Street at an investment bank. It's like an unbelievable story, and you can hear it in my voice as I tell it, until her life took her on a very unexpected and very important journey, a journey that took her all around the world to investigate and write about farms and what truly happens behind farm doors. This is her first book, and Sonia, I believe it will be released on July 15th. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I'm so excited to be on this show. Thank you, Gina, and thank you to listeners as well. July 15 is the date of release.
And you're already creating an international buzz, and I don't say that lightly. It's great to have you here. And I think that a very important way to frame this show, which you helped me with, because it was a difficult book for me to read in that the truth hurts. I knew a lot of things. I've watched a lot of documentaries, but the message that you want me and our listeners to take away is one of hope, possibility, and change. We'll cover some depressing facts, but at the end of the day, what are we going to do to make a difference? Is that fair to say? I'm going to cover some pretty heavy-duty stuff, but then change the framework.
Yes, that's precisely it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's start a little bit about your background in terms of what you thought your life was being prepared to do and the dramatic direction, change in direction it took.
Sure. So I like to say I fell into Project Animal Farm because that's certainly what it feels like even now. So I was an investment banker in New York after graduating from Dartmouth College. And lots of my classmates went into banking and consulting, and I did as well. And I would work late nights on Wall Street crunching numbers, and I loved my job. I loved the work. And then there was the economic recession in the U.S. where there were hundreds of thousands of layoffs, and I lost my job as well. And at the time, I was not happy about losing my job, but in retrospect, it was the best thing to happen to me because it allowed me to start thinking out of the box and to decide what I was interested in. And I think readers will see that transition in the book itself, changing as a person in pretty much every way possible.
And showing up in communities where, you know, the first one, I really did laugh out loud that you're the cute young person in the short skirt with dangly earrings and I'm sure very fashionable boots, and you're in farm country.
Yes, so I wanted a vacation, and I'd never been to a farm before, and I thought, oh, I live in a city, why don't I take a rural vacation and go somewhere? And I'd loved the Little House on the Prairie books as a kid, and I thought, you know, this will be fun. It'll be a nice change. So I emailed about a dozen small and organic farms and saying, can I come volunteer? And I thought they'd be really happy that, oh, someone's volunteering. But they didn't reply except for one where I ended up going, an organic dairy farm. and everything there was completely contrary to what I had imagined. The farmers, the animals, like everything about organic itself. So it was a very illuminating time.
You know, going back to setting the tone, it's kind of like jumping ahead to what we'll bring up at the end. You got to live in very intimate quarters, very close living quarters, staying in people's houses at times. And one of the things that impressed me is you didn't demonize these people. I mean, they were jobs. They were there sometimes multi-generational. They were thinking, yeah, feeling real human beings, with the exception of the guy that you referred to as Charlie. He was very tough to read about. But in general, you really were interacting with real people who were doing what seemed to me to be some pretty horrible, heinous things to animals.
Yes, so I really liked the people I met in Project Animal Farm. So I, like many people, had never really known farmers as friends, because the fact is there are very few farmers. I mean, less than 2% of people in the U.S. and Canada are in the agriculture industry. So that's not uncommon to not know any farmers. And I stayed at this organic dairy farm where I went to the farmer's birthday party. And there I met another farmer who I call Brick Roberts, who was very different than me in pretty much every way. But he was very nice and very warm to me. And that was his personality. So he had this facility and egg factory farm, but his personality was really kind, warm, sort of like an uncle who's somewhat gruff, but overall really nice. So it was definitely very enjoyable for me to meet these people and to live with them and get to know them. The tough part was the work that they did.
Right.
They themselves often didn't want to do.
So tell us about, you know, I don't know any other way to do it than go through some of the chapters and talk about the information. And as I said to you off air, we are definitely going to have you back for Project Animal Farm Part 2, where we focus on the impact of your book, how it's being received, and some of the perhaps changes that will come about as a result of it. So let's just start with organic dairy cows. I mean, it just sounds so great, doesn't it? Organic dairy cows. Tell us about the reality of that on an organic farm.
Sure. So organic means that animals have 120 days of outdoor access. So that's about one third of the year. One out of every 3 days of the year, they're supposed to be outside for some length of time at least. But the remaining days, the remaining two out of 3 days, do not have to be outside at all. So at this organic dairy farm, the cows were chained to stalls for most of the year, except for the 120 days. And cows, of course, are grazing animals. They've evolved to be on grass, to walk and to roam. And so chaining them to stalls, which are about no wider than the cow, they're just 2 feet wide or so, that's something that unnatural, it's unhygienic as well because of their living conditions. So organic is a good concept, the concept of having a more humane and sustainable farm, which is what stands behind organic, but the reality can be that it's not being practiced with the spirit, and farms are just trying to do the minimum while still meeting the regulations and thus having higher prices for their products. So often it can be more about profit than about philosophy, than about attachment to the work itself. And that is commonly the case. So organic has great potential, and I hope it realizes that potential once people start reading Project Animal Farm and thinking about these topics. But at this stage, organic hasn't quite reached its potential.
And it really is, when you talk about it, they're really literally tethered, and they can't turn their heads fully around. They can't move much. They can't move forward or backwards very much. I mean, it's a very confining, you know, to me, inhumane condition in which to live your life as a cow.
Yes, I mean, if we think about our cats and dogs, and these are easy animals to think about because so many of us do have cats and dogs and we're so attached to them, and we see that they're sentient beings that need to move. I mean, the word animal itself shares a root with animation, because the desire to move, the ability to move, is what sets an animal apart from a plant. So it's definitely not the right way to treat animals, and fortunately there's no reason for such a system to even exist. It exists now because people aren't really informed on these topics so much as yet, but there's no reason whatsoever for a cow to be chained to a stall all day.
It's really basically a money-making machine, literally, in every sense of the word. Mm-hmm. It's to maximize profits. That's not an understatement at all, right?
That's precisely it, yes.
And it's not easy doing that work. I have to kind of acknowledge that. What about calves? Mm-hmm. Did you find that in general, you know, we think about calves, and when I live in Arizona, and you can really see free-range cattle, and calves are adorable, and you stop the car. Mm-hmm. In this industry, what was your observation and experience about how calves are treated?
Sure. So calves can be separated into two kinds, I suppose, based on what their intended purpose is by the farm, whether they're dairy or whether they're beef cattle. So beef cattle overall, although there's definitely a shift toward feedlots, but there are many farms like the kinds you just mentioned and that I've seen as well, where the cows and calves are outside most of the year and are overall living good lives. Dairy is very different, though, in that so cows produce milk once they have a baby, like any other lactating mammal. So if they have a female calf, the farm keeps the calf, and the calf becomes a dairy cow when she's older. If it's a male calf, that calf becomes veal, which is a separate industry. So I think most of the calves we see outside tend to be beef calves. The dairy calves, the females, are often confined to sort of enclosures called hutches, which again there is no reason for. A lot of the things in agriculture I found, people in the industry were not questioning them. It's just, oh, everybody else is doing this, and so I'm going to do the same thing. Instead of thinking, do I even need to do this? Does this even help? Is this good in the long term for the animals? So the mindset was definitely very interesting, and I think that now we're at a time when farmers are getting interested in these issues because consumers are getting interested in them. And so it's definitely a fascinating time, and it's a really good sort of boiling point for change.
It's a good time for the consciousness to be raised. What about the difference between, there's organic dairy farms in the United States and Canada, and non-organic, that I think you refer to in the book as conventional farms? They're more of the norm. How does it go for the life of a cow in the in the conventional non-organic farms? Could it be worse? Is it worse?
That's a good question. It often is, unfortunately, worse, although it may not be. So there are some farms that are pretty much organic in principle and their practices, but they're not a certified organic because it's expensive and takes time and such. But conventional farms, for the most part, would be, they may not let the cow out at all for her whole life. So I visited lots of such dairy feedlots in the U.S. especially in the U.S., and the cows, I mean, organic at least says they have to be outside for 120 days. This says nothing. So there's no law. You can do whatever you want. Keep them as cramped together as you want. So that's unfortunately usually the case, where the conditions tend to be worse than organic.
And we just seem to be, like, we want to keep this on the note of people who are consuming in massive quantities, you know, the meat or the milk or whatever, it's not a consciousness that we've yet connected to, because we went from an agrarian society to everything being factory-based very quickly. So books like yours, I think, are going to be major steps to help raising the consciousness, because I think people really do want to know, and they can take it kind of in bite-sized chunks. And Sonia, I want to ask you, it seems to me that in every show I've ever done, when we're talking about food and food safety and food security, food scarcity, organic versus non-organic, Europe waxes us every time. Did you find that to be true? Does Europe have higher and better standards and better treatment of cows in general? And can you comment on what you found?
Yes. So Europe is going in a good direction. They've outlawed some practices that are very common in the U.S. and Canada, and their standards for everything are higher. For instance, their organic regulations mean more, a lot more than the same regulations in the U.S. and Canada. So, for instance, some practices like cages for hens, they've outlawed that, saying that it's inhumane and it's not okay. So, I mean, whichever kind of animal we look at, whether it's cows, whether we're talking organic or conventional or hens or pigs, Europe is making advances. In Europe, animal welfare is legally on the same footing as other societal principles like healthcare, like gender equality. So it is really being taken seriously by consumers, by industry, by government as well. And the level of consciousness is higher, the level of awareness, the level of understanding and sort of fixing these issues, I should say, is higher. And I'm hoping that the United States and Canada go in that direction, because Europe is sort of showing that things can be made better quite easily without having elevated costs, with consumer support, with industry support. So it's a really good role model for other places to follow.
So there again lies the hope. And before we go to break, and time is flying, I cannot believe we have about 2 minutes. I think it's important to discuss the very painful topic of artificial insemination, not only because it's harmful, but because of the impact the dairy industry has on agriculture and animal agriculture, you know, more than anything else. So can you talk a little bit about artificial insemination and what you found in general in the industry?
Yes. So what is artificial insemination? It's a form of reproduction that's non-natural, where the cow, for instance, is being inseminated with genes from a bull that's considered a top bull, for lack of a better term.
Right.
And the genetic considerations are heavily affected by very few factors. So in dairy cows, the factor is how much milk is being produced.
Right.
I mean, dairy cows today produce 20,000 pounds of milk a year.
That just blew me away.
Which is so significant, and it's very unnatural, that sort of production, and very profitable as well. But artificial insemination can result in cows who are not healthy because they're being bred to produce milk and more milk and more milk, and their strength of their legs, there are other features that lead to animal strength and health are not being prioritized. It's also...
Yeah, that's going to be, that's just a,
okay.
the music
okay.
for the break. So you can finish that thought when we come back about artificial insemination, and then we're going to move on to learning about the chickens. Everybody, please stay here with me. Sonia Farooqui, Project Animal Farm author and movement maker.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. The name of our show today is Project Animal Farm. Our guest is the author of the book by that name. Her name is Sonia Farooqui. She is amazing. She's an Ivy League graduate and an investment banker, and she had no idea the night that she arrived at the doorstep of a dairy farm that it would mark the beginning of a journey that would ultimately wind all the way around the world. And instead of turning away from the animal cruelty she came to witness, she made a very courageous decision, perhaps the most courageous of your life. I don't know, Sonia. I'm going to stay tuned. But a commitment to change things. And there is no doubt in my mind that you're already succeeding. Once again, Sonia, thanks for being with us. And let's continue what your thought was about artificial insemination.
Sure. Thank you, Gina. I'm having a lot of fun discussing these topics.
I am too. It's like to know better is to do better. And that's what I want our listeners to feel is that, yeah, it's tough to hear, but then we can be part of the change we really want to see and that we can help bring about as consumers. So let's talk about these poor cows getting artificially inseminated.
So artificial insemination, I compare it in Project Animal Farm to a complex pot of genes being passed through a needle pinhole. It's really very specific genes are being selected that are not genes for better health or strength, but just for higher production and higher profits. So more than 90% of cows in the U.S. and Canada, of dairy cows and sows, female pigs, are artificially inseminated instead of having natural reproduction.
And it's just like that's an astounding figure. And in that cocktail mix that you talk about are antibiotics, and you know later on I'd like to talk a little bit about penicillin, but basically it compromises all of our health and the health of the planet. So that's very, very troubling to me, the overuse of antibiotics. So let's move on a little bit to the chickens. And this is another just fun-filled bit of information. And, you know, I have to use a little bit of humor, but really another tough read. You just don't want to be born a chicken in a chicken foundry. Factory. So tell us your general overview about what you found when you started to explore chicken factories. Where do you begin?
Sure. So I met a farmer, Brick Roberts, at a party, and I went to stay with him in his house. He had a farm of egg-laying hens. And I should mention that chickens today are separated into two kinds and are treated very differently and completely different breeds. So there's the egg-laying hens and there's the broiler chickens, which are the chickens on the shelves. And the egg-laying hens produce the eggs that are on the shelves. So egg-laying hens, more than 95% of them in the U.S. and Canada, are kept in tiny cages. So I went to this factory farm of these cages, and I visited several times because I was living with the family. And hens are stacked from the floor to the ceiling in places like this, which are often dark and very dirty. I've never been allergic to anything, but when I went to this farm, I felt that I must have the flu or some sort of sickness, because as soon as I would go in, I would start coughing and sneezing, and my eyes would start tearing. And that's really how dirty the environment is, and the hens are in that environment for their whole lives. So each cage is about the size of a microwave. Think of your microwave. Yes, it's shocking to think of it because it's such a small space. But it's five hens in a cage of about that size is a very common thing that I've seen.
And you talked about, like, we have to talk about it. So there's a very painful process about, you described debeaking. Tell us what it is and why, what the purpose is from the eye of the egg-laying farmer.
Sure. So the more I looked into these topics for Project Animal Farm, the more convoluted everything, the more convoluted everything seems. So because the hens are in these cages, they're an environment which is completely unnatural. Like, imagine being in a sort of tiny bed or a tiny sort of couch or anything with lots of people on top of each other, and it's just not a comfortable environment by any means. And it's the same with hens. So in a natural condition, a hen would just move away from the hen she doesn't like.
Right.
But in a cage, there's nowhere for them to move. And so if one hen pecks the other, they might peck each other to death because it's such a horrible environment for them to be in. So instead of taking them out of cages, the egg industry instead debeaks them. It cuts off the tip of the beak, the sharp tip. And the hens have this sort of funny or like strange appearance where they look like they're pouting, but it's a condition where they're taking these sorts of band-aid measures to make things continue to work, when really the better solution would be to overhaul the system and to have a free-range system instead.
You know, there was a point, many, many points in the book, where I just kind of had a very authentic and honest, deep sense of gratitude for your courage and your staying in the fire, is an expression I used. You stood in the fire. You could have
run
and gone back to your Wall Street job and a New York apartment and, you know, had a couple of weeks' experience, but you kept at it. And I want to talk about the, you know, what happens. It's basically an 18-month lifespan for these chicken-producing eggs. I mean, it's not a really very long lifespan. And then what happens to them?
So then they are trucked to slaughter. And one of the many interesting things I learned in Project Animal Farm is how complex it is. So the same hen's body parts, part of them may be sold in McDonald's, part of them elsewhere, and other parts may be shipped to places like China. So very far away and very uncontrollable, which means that if there is a disease outbreak, and so often we're reading about bird flus, and I've been to places with these sorts of issues. If there's any outbreak or any disease, it can spread very far, very fast, and wreak a lot of harm.
We were in Hong Kong when there was the the bird flu for chickens, and it was mm-hmm. unbelievable what happened instantly, and you're right. And again, another point I thought interesting in the book was organically raised dairy cows, which sounds like such a premium, their value mm-hmm. is actually not very high once their life is over. Is that a fair statement?
That's exactly it, yes.
So they go to places like McDonald's, and it's like for pennies on the dollar.
So they're considered sort of old and spent, and they become hamburgers. And it doesn't really matter too much at all if it was the cow was raised organically or not. But they're mostly going to fast food places.
And that's pretty. It was pretty hard to read. So let's talk about in terms of the hens laying eggs. I just feel like I have to talk about blowout a little bit. It was an upsetting thing to read about. It is the number one cause of death for the egg-laying hens, I believe. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how unnatural? That's the part that I think we should emphasize, because if we go back to mm-hmm. natural, nature will right itself.
Yes. So blowout is something that's fairly common in the egg industry today. It means the hens are laying eggs that are too big and too often as well. Hens today are bred to have this outrageous egg lay rate of about 300 eggs a year, 6 eggs a week. And it can lead to them having, like, their insides might come out with the eggs occasionally, and then other hens peck the insides and the hen eventually dies, a very sort of cruel death. So this was one of the things I learned in Project Animal Farm that I had no idea about. But again, it leads to a situation that can easily be fixed by just by paying attention to genetics and the environment both, which are together creating the sort of negative living condition for the hens.
And it was very interesting to me also, pretty much the lack of human contact. I mean, some of the places you describe, literally the entire factory was being controlled by a switchboard. Is that a fair assessment as well?
Yes. So at these factory farms, the interesting thing is that they're completely stuffed with animals to the ceiling, literally, 10 feet high, but there are no people needed and wanted either. It got costs to automate everything. So there's often a big switchboard with lots of buttons. You press one button and the egg belt starts rolling and the eggs are created and packed automatically. Another button is for another belt, and everything is controlled in this way such that there's no need to interact with the hens. There's no need to even go in. Often just one worker is responsible for tens or hundreds of thousands of hens.
And they're just feeding them and cleaning up after them. I mean, and I put this in my notes about scientists describing a hen's natural instinct is to work for food rather than accept free food from a feeder. And hens want to forage, not fester in a cage. I mean, again, it's going back to the natural order of things. And again, the workers, yeah. It kind of shocked me a little. It didn't shock me, but some of the workers, they believe the hens live better than we do. And is that something you think they have to believe, or they really and truly believe that this is a way that anybody would want to, you know, show up on the planet?
Right. So two things I'd like to mention. One of the things that didn't make it into Project Animal Farm, but which I found interesting at this hen facility I was staying in, is hens want to, as you said, work for food instead of having the food sitting right in front of them. So one of the buttons at this place was to keep rotating the feed belts. So there was a belt of corn in front of the cages. And so they would press a button every few hours and it would rotate. And the reason for that was that hens were sort of not interested in the food unless it was sort of moving. There was some movement there.
Right. Like the hunt.
Yes, it's right. Finding food in a way. So it was, it's so much a part of their nature, as you said. And the psychological parts of all of this were very interesting as well. One of my most fascinating conversations in Project Animal Farm was with a worker here called Paul.
Right.
Who didn't view the hens as hens. He didn't view them as birds at all. So we were having a conversation where he was saying that my sister loves her bird. She has a lovebird, and she's always talking to the bird. And he said, if I had a bird, it would die in a day because I wouldn't be able to take care of it. And I was thinking, you're surrounded by 13,000 birds. So what are these if they're not birds? But there was that concept that these are separate. They're sort of object, and it's sort of like a warehouse where they're just stacked up like any object would be. So there is this sort of mental distancing that's almost necessary if you're doing this job for 35 years, as Paul was and as other people are. And it's a conversation that then becomes strange because you're both looking at the same animal, a hen, and you're viewing that same animal so differently.
And I couldn't help but thinking, you do refer to it throughout the book about, you know, George Orwell's 1984. And I'm like, yeah, here we are, 2015, live from a lot of things that are going on right now. And I think it was, I love your quotes from Temple Grandin, who is a well-known and respected animal expert and scientist. And her quote, one of them I picked, egg-laying hens were nervous wrecks that had beaten off half their feathers from the constant flapping against their cages. So that was referring to battery cages. Can you tell us a little bit about that not-so-lovely condition and what battery cages are?
Yes, so these cages are called battery cages, and the name comes from the idea of a battery of tests. There's just so many of them lined up together, thousands of them. So as Temple Grandin said, and if you go to one of these places, the hens, when you walk through the aisle, they're terrified and they're flapping their feathers. Like in natural conditions, they would just move away from the source of fear, like an outsider, but here they can't, and so they just sort of flap away. So they definitely do lose their feathers through the flapping, through feather pecking, and through grating against the bars of the cage as well. Looking at these hens, you can tell this animal is not healthy, this animal is not happy. And then, again, what does that say about the eggs that they're laying?
And that we're eating.
Yes. Like,
there's that part. Exactly. We're part of that incredibly toxic, in some ways, food chain. And one of the things that I thought sometimes was overwhelming that we can talk about in our 2 minutes before the next break is the smell. You refer to the smell of ammonia a lot in the places that you went because of the manure. What about the impact on your health? Were you thinking about that? And what is the impact on the health of the workers that have to go in?
The impact on health is very significant. This worker, Paul, who'd worked here for 35 years, he had this permanent cough. And it was, I mean, it sounds like if you think of someone who has a really strong flu, I mean, that's how he was for the last decades. In terms of my health, because I was going in for stretches of time and so it was something I wasn't too concerned about. I just felt bad for the animals because they're there for their whole lives, and I can hardly even take it for an hour or two, whereas they're trapped there permanently. And so I was thinking a lot about that side of things.
And the, I mean, literally a physical effect I had when I was reading the book. It's like, oh my gosh, it's kind of, you can almost, it sounds ridiculous, but I could almost smell it. It's like, get me out of here. So we're going to have to take another break, and I want to talk more when we come back about pigs, that part of the book, and then the good news, Animal Heaven, we'll do that, and about how this experience has changed your life forever. When we come back, everybody, we'll be talking more with Sonia Faruqi. She is the author of Project Animal Farm. Please stay here with us.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I certainly can attest to the fact that our author, our guest today, Sonia Faruqi, she wrote the book Project Animal Farm that's going to be released on July 15th. The book is about an accidental journey into the secret world of farming and the truth about our food. And it's about Sonia's unprecedented quest and incredibly underscore exclamation point courageous journey that gives us a riveting and revealing book about what really does happen behind farm doors. And as I said throughout the broadcast, Sonia's purpose in writing the book was not to depress everybody and make us all sad, but to more inspire us and to become conscious to consumers and be a part of the change, given her powerful insights and what she has shared with us about the most important thing in our lives, which is the food that keeps us alive. So, Sonia, there's another glowing list of praise from Mrs. Green, and thank you for your great work and for being with us today.
Thank you, Mrs. Green. That's very kind of you, and I'm glad you've been liking the book.
I'm telling you, I hope it creates another big, huge ripple effect throughout the world, and I believe it will. So let's talk about pigs. First of all, they are among the most intelligent of animals, and I really want to underscore that, and yet they are the worst treated of them all. What was your overall experience with pigs and pig farming? Disturbing details.
Sure. So pigs today, the sows, the female pigs who give birth to piglets, are generally kept in crates. And these crates are, they're about, I describe them in Project Animal Farm as being the width of my shoulders. They're very narrow crates where the sow, if she lays down, her legs are in the crate of her neighbor. And it's remarkable because I went to this sow factory farm at night with a bunch of guys who were smoking pot and drinking and all kinds of things. And the sows, when we went in, we switched on the light and went in, they were screaming, and their screams sound really human. And I find that eerie. And they were also hitting their heads against their crates. They were biting the bars of their crates. They were, it was like they were deranged, and that's the sort of environment they're kept in, which is so very constrictive. I had a conversation with the pig farmer, and when I looked at the crates, I was wondering, what are these overhead bars for? Like, in addition to the crate having bars to either side of the sow, there are also these overhead bars above them. And he said that if there are no bars, they'll keep trying to step out of their crates. Even if you make the walls very high, they'll just keep doing their best to jump out of the crates. That's how much they hate it. So that's how a lot of sows today are kept, and there's no reason for that. Europe has said no to such a system. And in the United States and Canada as well, there's no reason for sows to ever be in crates.
It was really, really disturbing. I mean, everybody, you've got to read it. You'll never feel the same about bacon again. And is it fair to say that in the industry, the animals are really talked about more as commodities and earnings per share and the balance sheet than about living, breathing creatures of the planet?
Yes, that's very much the case. If you look up the corporations who have hundreds of factory farms and you look at their annual reports and other documents, animals are very much being referred to as commodity, as prices per pound, as live weight, and that's how the industry is viewing them, as just that. What is the profit per pig? What is the profit per pound to the cent? And costs are also cut to the cent. So they're really not being viewed as sentient beings, as animals with a mind, animals with desires, like any other animal, animals who at least want to move. They're being viewed completely as objects to exploit to the limit.
And the thing that also struck me is the marketing they do versus what they're actually really doing, like farm fresh pork in their logo. You don't ever see pictures of steel crates, no concrete pens, no electric prods. And again, was this one of the most pervasive in terms of the use of penicillin, which is really, from what I understood, to increase their appetite? I mean, it compromises our entire immune system in the world as a planet. So was penicillin most pervasively used in the pig farms that you visited?
So antibiotics are a very important issue in terms of long-term health.
Right.
In Project Animal Farm, in this pig factory farm where I spent an evening, the sows were being injected by antibiotics by the factory farmer. He was literally going down the rows and injecting them, and that's very common. So penicillin has or antibiotics in general, often their effects in animals are different than in us. In animals, for whatever reason, antibiotics increase appetite. So if farmers use them, so the animals grow faster and they gain more weight and it's more profitable that way. But these same antibiotics, penicillin and others, are used to treat human bacterial infections, and they have a very important role in that area. But the overuse of antibiotics on farms results in bacteria mutating and becoming more resistant to the antibiotics. So 75% of antibiotics are used not by humans, but they're used in farm animals, which is really a huge amount, penicillin and lots of other antibiotics as well.
It's a shocking statistic. I mean, it really is. 70% in the in the United States alone. To me, it puts human lives at stake so that we can generate better revenues. And, you know, I think it was interesting because I don't think you could read the book and not love Brick as seen through your eyes. And he had an interesting journey and had a pig farm that burned down. Yes?
Yes, he did.
And then he decided that he was going to go in another direction. And I love the quote that you read about him, about free-range farms and the big myth around that. I don't want to read the quote, but it's not working with Mother Nature.
Yes. So Rick Roberts, who has this egg-laying hen factory farm, also has a free-range turkey farm. He previously had a pig farm, which burned down, and that's another point mentioned in Project Animal Farm. There's so many gases from all the manure that pig factory farms literally catch fire. So many of them have been catching fire in the U.S. and Canada. But anyhow, so Brick starts a free-range turkey farm, which is really, really profitable. So he views free-range in general as a scam, which it can be and often, unfortunately, is. But in a professional context, he would always say, we work with Mother Nature, not against her, when it's not quite the case.
And it was, we have to inject a little humor here because I'm going out of order, but I really don't want to have the show go past this. When you talked about the deer sighting, it wasn't really funny, but it's so worth your sharing our thoughts about what happened to you in the deer sighting. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so on the way back from this pig factory farm, it was around 10 p.m. at night, and I'm in this truck with these three young farmers who are smoking pot and drinking.
And there you are.
Such a strange environment. And so we're driving past, and I'm very shocked to see a deer farm. I mean, I hadn't known that deer farms even exist. Most people don't know that. And as I was sitting there, I had so many thoughts. I mean, at one point, pigs lived like deer. They lived outdoors and in a natural environment. Today, these deer are still kept outdoors behind a fence, but they still have some area to roam, and they're still outdoors. What about the future? If we're looking at 2050, how are deer going to be kept then? Will people develop a taste for venison like they have for bacon? And what does that mean? What does that spell for deer? It doesn't spell anything good. But the fact that so much has happened in other areas of agriculture so quickly and so uncontrollably, and I hope it doesn't happen for other animals like deer.
It was a great warning sign, and it was humorous how you said stop, and then there was the deer farm. But then you went on to explain, I mean, deer, so elegant and alert, and you started thinking about it was just less than half a century ago, as you said, that pigs were living in the outdoors, in open air, under the sun and the stars. I'm quoting from the book, and now from birth to death in closed factories. Out of sight, out of mind, nobody knows it, and they just show up in the grocery store wrapped in cellophane on, you know, styrofoam. There's another horrible conversation to go on, and your chapter in that says, when will it begin for deer, and where will it end for pigs? So I think it's a great thing to talk about. So before we are over the show, which we only have about 7 minutes left, I want to talk briefly about castration, because it seems to me that there might be some hope there. It is painful. It does hurt, scientifically proven. So what's your overview of that? And do you think that we're on the right track in terms of abandoning that process, the castration of pigs?
Sure. So pigs, male pigs today are for the most part in the U.S. and Canada castrated. And it's a practice that's so common, and it's often done for no real reason anymore. Previously, it was said that, oh, the flesh of a boar has a taint, and we don't want that. But now, because the slaughter age of animals has actually decreased so much, it doesn't matter. But anyhow, Castration is very common, very painful. It's done without any anesthetic. And there's no reason for it to be done, and there's never a reason that it should be done without anesthetic. So in Europe, though, they're moving away from this practice for the fact that it's inhumane. Interestingly, the pig industry itself has said, we don't want to do this anymore. And pigs, as of, I think, 2018, they're no longer going to be castrated. And that's a step that offers a really good direction that can also easily be done in the U.S. and Canada.
And I think your book has lots of glimmers of hope throughout this, even just starting with to know better is to do better for us as consumers. So it's like, and everybody, if you read it and you're turning the page, turning the page, turning the page, hold on for joy in chapter 6, which is called Animal Heaven, Quality with a Conscience. And I think it's kind of funny how you were at the point in your journey that you hesitated to even believe about the Harley mm-hmm. Farms website. So tell us about that and the good news. We only have about 4 minutes left.
Okay. So I visit this farm, which is a large pastoral farm, and Project Animal Farm. Later on in the book, as I go through my journey, I recommend large pastoral as an important and very tangible and viable solution to the problems we have today. So in this chapter 6, Animal Heaven, I am at a really beautiful farm run by a family that moved to North America from England, and to them, animal welfare comes first. So it's a farm where pigs, sheep, and cows are outdoors year-round, and they're very happy, and animal happiness is so easy to see. They're really happy, healthy animals. And it's an economic farm. It's it does well. The farmer does well. The family does well. The land is well taken care of as well. So it was very different from these factory farms. I mean, a pastoral farm and an industrial farm have absolutely nothing in common. And there are some farms like these that are sprouting up, and I hope to encourage more such farms and through my book, Project Animal Farm. But they offer a really good solution and possibility to the sort of conventional factory farm production system that's common today.
And what would you say to people that challenged you with, we need volume, we have billions of people on the planet, they need to be fed, this is really the only way we can meet that demand? What would your response to that be?
Sure. Two parts to that response. The first is that people today are eating way more animal products than they ever have, and it's not good for them at all, or for the world, or animals, certainly. So we don't need to be, and nor should we be, eating so much. But so, I mean, cutting down on meat consumption is really important. The average American consumer eats over 170 pounds of meat a year, not including fish even, and which is really a shocking number. The other part of that is large pastoral can be economic because there are large numbers of animals.
Right.
So it's, essentially you can take out the animals from a factory farm and put them in a pastoral farm. So it's really doing a good job of maintaining the land and the animal welfare while also not being expensive because of the economies of scale.
So it is making small changes, and we have less than a minute, and I don't want it to go by without you sharing with people how they can best stay connected with you, your Facebook page, ordering your book, and where all that happens. So let's do that really quickly.
Yes, I'd love to hear from listeners and readers. I can be reached at my website, www.soniafaruqi.com. My book, Project Animal Farm, is available everywhere in bookstores, online, Amazon, everywhere. And you can find me on Twitter at @Sonia_Faruqi and Facebook. And let's stay connected.
Let's stay connected, and I promise I'll have you back next week. Friend and repeat guest Mark Yagi, Waterkeepers Alliance, sharing with us important updates on that information. Thank you, Sonia.
Thank you.